So today, and Perul, is your father there with you?
He is. He's not right here in the room with me, but he's wanting to come up, actually. I just wanted to make sure it would be okay first.
Oh, 100%.
Okay.
Just fine. Though what we're talking about is today, we're going less into the Jyotish side of things and more into Vedic philosophy. And
yes, chapter two.
So what the class schedule is going to look like is today. I'm hoping to get through maybe the first half of chapter two, and next week I'm going to be traveling in Arizona. Ian is going to focus on the first third of chapter three with you guys. And then the week I come back, we'll do the second half of chapter two. And then it's going to be Ian again doing the last third of chapter three. And then I'll do the middle third of chapter three with you. And the first third and the last third, it's a lot about calculations and stuff that you should have to memorize. So it's something that Ian is going to be able to work with you. And you know, me, I memorized it 20-something years ago. So to me, it's like the English language. I can't not know it. And our goal is to make it that comfortable for you. So Ian is going to work with that. But today we're going to do the first part of chapter two. And The first big thing is why chapter two, and I'm sure I tell the story in the recording that the first class when I came back and my guru said it's time to start teaching, my first class I did this chapter two first, and I had about 30 people come, and the next class only about 8 or so, I don't know, some very small number returned. And so I was like, you know, that was a bad sign that class didn't go well. And looking at it deeply, you know, people came to learn astrology. And so when I started talking about Vedic philosophy, it just wasn't landing for them. They're like, I want to learn astrology. And so I got like, oh, I have to explain why we want to learn Vedic philosophy. So that's the first thing I'm going to talk about. And we are doing Vedic astrology. We're not just doing sidereal astrology with some Indian techniques. And so when we say Vedic, why do we use the word Vedic versus just calling it Indian astrology? Because when we look at Indian astrology and classical Greek astrology are 90% the same. Just let that sit with you for a minute. Indian astrology and classical Greek, what the Greeks back in pre-Christ time period were working with was 90% the same as what they were doing in India. So why don't we just call it, you know, ancient astrology? Why are we calling it Vedic? So we want to have the Vedic philosophy. We want to understand the Vedic perception of the world. We're going to be learning within the framework of the Vedic sages and the Vedic teachings. And one of my inspirations, and I probably say it in the video, but there was somebody, they'd been studying astrology more than two decades, Vedic astrology more than two decades, and Guruji was talking about making a beginner level class, and he starts talking about what would need to be in a beginner level class, and he talked about some things, and then this woman, for like more than two decades, she's been doing Vedic astrology, she said, well, what are the Vedas? And he almost, it was just very difficult for him. Something that his life it revolves around. It's almost like asking an American, what's a smartphone? You know, everybody just knows what a smartphone is. It's like what planet are you on? You don't know what a smartphone is. How we would react. to somebody who didn't know what a smartphone was. So for him, like, the Vedas are like, you know, you check your smartphone how many times a day? And maybe I won't even go if somebody doesn't have a smartphone. If you don't have a smartphone, then I'll just say your email so many times a day. You know, it's this technology that we rely on, and our life is being guided by this thing. You know, you get emails and it says, oh, I'm going to be late, and so you know that late's happening, and you get another email that we didn't get your registration. So your life and what you're doing is being guided by these emails and this smartphone. So in the same way, the Vedas and their philosophy, they're guiding our choices. They're guiding our thought process. They're guiding the choices that we're making and the goggles that we're wearing. So we want to understand what are these Vedas. And some of you have listened to this class online, and I know some of you haven't, because we're at the beginning here. And sometimes it's easier to listen before, sometimes it's easier to talk about a little bit and then listen. But looking, we have page 17. Page 17 has, you know, the 14 Vidyastanas. And I'll let, you know, if you haven't read, I'll let you go into that. I'm going to jump right into the philosophical stuff. Because some of that other stuff is already explained in the online video. And so on page 18, the middle section, last paragraph, last word in that, there's a quote by Swami Sivananda. And Swami Sivananda says, the Vedas are eternal spiritual truths. Vedas are an embodiment of divine knowledge. The books may be destroyed, but the knowledge cannot be destroyed. Knowledge is eternal. In that sense, the Vedas are eternal. So we want to really get that, you know, when people say that the Vedas are millions of years old, or they're eternal and they were perceived, that it's not particularly just the little words or the book that we're talking about. What we're talking about is the concepts. We're talking about the perception that is being presented. And so let's turn that into a modern day analogy. If we would say, I'm working for something right off of our, tomorrow we have a new president, you know, in America. So if we look at the Republicans who are about to take power, they have a doctrine, they have a certain belief system. If somebody's called a Republican, that doesn't mean to us that they're following a book. In the culture that is more Christianized, there's this concept of a book and it being the holy word of God, and it being and that's a very Christian concept. When we enter the Vedic realm, yes, there's Vedic verses, but we're not just focused on the Vedas as books. We're looking at the you know, when we look at the Republicans, when somebody says a Republican, you know that they want to lower taxes, you know that you got a general idea of the realm that they believe. Versus if somebody is a Democrat, you have a general idea of what they're believing. And not everybody who's a Democrat is going to believe the same thing. And so in the Vedic paradigm, just because somebody is a Vedika, you know, somebody who's a practitioner, or somebody who's working with the Vedic knowledge, it doesn't mean we're all going to agree. But there's a general premise, a general direction of our thinking that has a specific direction. Does that make sense? Everybody with me? All right. So we're looking at a paradigm. Let's see. So the first thing I bring up here is the Vedas do not say that one path is right and another is wrong. And one of the situations we have with that is in the actual Vedas, there's And we find it in the Bible as well, that there's multiple authors with multiple opinions. But what happened is the Roman Catholic Church said, no, no, we can't have disagreements. We have to have what the official word is. And so they threw out certain books from the Bible. And then even though there's a few different views in the Bible, they kind of said, no, no, we don't believe in that view. They're really meaning this. And they gave this belief system that you had to believe. But the Vedas, that didn't happen. There was no what they call standardization. In the Vedas, we have different rishis. And these different rishis are giving different teachings. And just as an example, there's three different sections on creation. And in the one creation, which is mentioned here, it ends, this is what we say creation came from, but who really knows? You know, who was actually there to see it? And so they're sitting there saying, you know, this is what we're believing, but if you weren't there, it's just a belief. And they're really differentiating that. So it really, on a certain level, pulls the rug out from belief. You know, we're believing something because we are choosing to believe it. We're not believing it because it's the real truth, reality that an eternal God made up. From the Vedic perspective, God is completely beyond everything. God's not writing books. Humans are writing books. They might have some holy inspiration, but humans are writing books. All right, so let's look at this. Is everybody with me? All right. So, and you know, the plus and the minus of this philosophy that we have happening is, when you get, for example, some of the Christian ideology, they believe they're right. You know, particularly the Roman Catholic Church. Starting from 313, when the emperor became a Christian, he said, this is Christianity, this is the right way. And he decided to kill anybody who didn't believe and agree with him. Now, and he went out and he started conquering anybody who didn't agree and converting them. Now, from a Vedic paradigm, if you say, you know, this is what you believe, this is what I believe, and, you know, maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong, but this is what I'm believing because this is what works for me. You're not going out and conquering and killing anybody for your belief. So this lower level, I'm right religion, it spreads itself much easier. Where this more open-minded, all-accepting spirituality, it doesn't spread itself to the same level. It has to be from the inside people seeking. It's not a government that has the ability to impose it upon you. All right. So, let's see. They proclaim... All right. So we're going to go straight from the Nasadiya Sukta. And the Nasadiya Sukta is one of the creation myths. And this is, and you'll see how much I'm going to draw out of this verse. And I just want to make it clear that every verse in the Vedas, you can draw out this much from. I'm using this verse because what's in it is important for us as astrologers. So verse 1, there was neither non-existence nor existence then. And so it's talking about in the beginning, before creation. There was neither the realm of space nor sky which is beyond. What stirred where, in whose protection? Was there water bottomlessly deep? All right. So that's you, Ian. Maybe. Or it's Ravi is who that is. All right. So here, was there water bottomlessly deep? Now who knows the beginning verses of Genesis? Anybody know off the top of their head the beginning verses of Genesis?
In the beginning there was light?
Even before that.
The void.
And I'm just going to go off the top of my head. If you want like exact, go ahead and look it up. But it says across the fathomless deep, God said, let there be light. So it spoke about there being this ocean that existed before. And that ocean that existed before was a mythology that came from the Babylonians. It ends up in Genesis, but most of Genesis is a Babylonian story. That has been well documented since, but so there's some people believing that there's this great ocean there. Now, ocean, not ocean, right here it's saying, was there water bottomlessly deep? It says, you know, it's asking, really, was there? Like, who can you really say that there was this ocean of bottomlessly deep? You know, it's kind of just, it's questioning. It's not saying there is. Notice, this is a creation sukta, and it starts with questions. It doesn't start with answers. And I just want to be real. Notice that. It's starting with questions. It's not saying, believe this. It's saying, on a certain level, it's saying, question what you believe. Question these stories. Question what you're being told. So the Vedas, from the very beginning, are inspiring us to dig within and to inquire. They're not asking us to be to believe something with faith without questioning. And we'll look at that verse again. There was neither non-existence nor existence then. There was neither the realm of space nor sky. So it's talking about before anything was created. What stirred? Where did it stir? In whose protection? Was there water bottomlessly deep? Is there somebody protecting it? Was there something there? Was there not something there? Then verse 2, which is on page 19. There was neither death nor immortality then, because nothing was created. There was no distinguishing sign of day or night, which goes back to that whole let there be light concept. That oneness breathed without air by its own impulse. Now, that verse, that oneness breathed without air by its own impulse, that gets developed much later in the tantras. They go very deep into that. Other than that, there was nothing beyond. So it's first thing that it gives us here. You know, we don't know what was there, but it says that there's this oneness that breathed by its own impulse. Now, we can think about that as the universe, but now think about yourself. If you say, who am I? What am I? What is this being that I am? Where did I come from? If you look, there's something in you that is a pulsing heart, and you're breathing in and out. You're guaranteed that's what you are, right? None of us here can say that we're not a pulsing heart breathing in and out. We all agree that that's like this prime nature. Without that beating heart and breathing in and out, there'd be no life. So the Vedic concept is as the universe is, so are we. As we, so is the universe. So if this is the core, our core essence, then there must be this reflection of this core pulsation, breathing in and out. This is the core life. And from that essence that came us, we're this individual essence of this pulsation that's breathing. So somewhere in the core, there's this pulsation breathing. And then we're going back to the cosmic level. Darkness was hidden by darkness in the beginning, with no distinguishing sign. All this was water, the potential of creation. The life force was covered with emptiness. That one arose by the power of heat. So here it's giving a concept. And this power of heat, it's very particular, and I'm going to go right into the next verse. Desire came upon the one in the beginning. That was the first seed of mind. So the first seed of mind is this concept of desire. And just side note, in the tantras, that concept gets developed into kriya, jnana, and icha shakti. And it directly is coming from the Vedas here, the kriya, jnana, and icha shakti. And this desire, this icha, this will, there's a desire, there's an impulse. Why are you here? Why are you breathing? Why are you eating? You know, why anything? Who knows? But there's an impulse that's making you do it, right? Now, somebody can make up a reason why, and it might be right, it might not be right. But we know that for something, there's this impulse that's pushing us forward, right? There's an impulse that's moving us every day. So this desire, this impulse, that's considered the first seed of mind. There was an urge that came forth. Who knows where it's coming from, what it is, but that urge has heat to it. And it began movement. Things began to stir because of that urge, that desire.
Is that the Atma?
We save that question for level two. Chapter one of level two, we go into that, how Atma comes out of this. But that's too complex for just this look at it. But it's directly coming from here, yes. But here leave that. Chapter one of volume two. And so the next verse here, poets seeking in their heart with wisdom found the bond of existence in non-existence. So we look at this verse four. Desire came upon that one in the beginning. That was the first seed of mind. Poets seeking in their heart with wisdom found the bond of existence in non-existence. So there was nothing, and then somehow the whole universe was created. So that non-existence all of a sudden became an existence. So that bond, like, how did non-existence turn into all of this that we're looking at right now? It doesn't sit there and tell us this is how it happened, but it tells us that the sages looked inside their heart and they could see. So it's telling us, you know, it started with questions. It didn't start by telling us what was up. And then here it's telling us that there's this pulsation, there's breathing, there's desire. This is all fact. We all know this is in us. And then it says, look inside. Go inside. And with wisdom, we can perceive why this is here. We can perceive that connection between existence and non-existence. This pulsation, this breathing, this urge, this desire. And from the Vedic perspective, those three things are all connected. And they have their cosmic level that is bringing everything into existence. And then they have within us, some desire existed in us which gave us birth. And this desire giving us birth, in order for us to become alive, there's this pulsation of who we are. And that pulsation is beating our heart. It's making us inhale and exhale. And as soon as that pulsation leaves us, leaves this body, I can't say it leaves us. As soon as that pulsation leaves this body, what is this body? It's instantly dead. It's just elements. There's nothing. So this pulsation, and looking at that pulsation, we can understand how the whole world came into existence. When we understand how we came into existence. All right. Verse 5. So, beautiful verses here, huh? Beautiful verses. If you read it too fast, how much you miss? Verse 5. I'll read 4 again. Desire came upon the one in the beginning. That was the first seed of mind. Poets seeking in their heart with wisdom found this bond of existence in non-existence. Their ray of light was extended across. Was there below? Was there above? So it's talking about the creation. You know, this desire. Was there above? Was there below? There were seed placers. There were powers. There was impulse beneath. There was giving forth above. So they're almost getting into, if you think about a plant, there were seed placers. But think about it as a plant there. A ray of light extended across. Was there below? Was there above? It's a question. There were seed placers. There were powers. This impulse beneath, you know, something underneath was giving it impulse. And there was a giving forth above that something grew out of. So it's using almost a plant analogy, but it's also using that for our soul and our human incarnation. It's also using it for how the universe came into to being. It's not saying this is why, this is how. It's like, you know, look at how the whole universe is manifesting. That's how universes manifest. That's how us as souls, as beings are manifesting. And then it says, there was impulse beneath, there was impulse, there was impulse beneath, there was giving forth above. So we have that plant analogy for the whole universe, for our own soul being. And then it says, who really knows? Who will here proclaim it? How was it produced? How did this creation come to be? So who's going to sit there and say, you know, now when we look at the Bible, people say it's the Word of God. Now, what this is saying is, okay, you say that book's the Word of God, but come on. Tell me you know that that's how creation came about. Did you see it? Did you experience it? It's really clear. Who really knows? Who can proclaim it? Who can tell me that this is the truth because they saw it themselves? The gods came afterwards with the creation of the universe. Who then knows where this creation has arisen from? Whence this creation has arisen? Perhaps it formed itself. Perhaps it did not. The one who looks down on it in the highest heaven, only he knows, or perhaps he doesn't know. All right. So we see these verses on one level, they're very simple. On another level, if I wanted to, I could probably talk for an hour just on those last two verses. But I'm not going to over-focus on those verses. But so the Vedas, it's not the fact that it's a book. And yes, it is a book and there's some verses there, but what is being presented is question reality. Don't believe something just because it's said. Look inside. Look at the core essence of reality. Inside, the answers exist. Don't walk around acting like you know everything. God isn't proclaiming anything. Who knows if God even knows himself? You know, there's a certain attitude that's being presented here. And it's that attitude that our Vedas, that we're going to, if we look at, you know, you go back to Swami Sivananda's definition here, Vedas are eternal spiritual truths. Vedas are an embodiment of divine knowledge. The books may be destroyed, but the knowledge cannot be destroyed. This is eternal knowledge. In that sense, these Vedas are eternal. It's this knowledge. It's this concept. It's this attitude. It's this way of perceiving. And it's that's eternal. So even if the books are lost, it will be reborn. Because this understanding, you know, and I explain it now, and you might be able to sit there and say, yes, I agree with that. And maybe one or two of you might be like, yeah, but I don't agree with that part. You know, somebody might believe that God knows. But, like, prove to me that God knows. You can't. Somebody might have told you that God knows, but you can't prove that God knows. So here we just have a very, you know, this is, we're being requested to be humble. We can believe something, but just really be aware that what you're believing, like, How true could it really be? All right. Let's see. Inquiry. I'm going to skip the next verse because I go into that in the online lesson. Any questions with that creation sukta? So, let's see. We're going to look at the top verse on page 20, and we're going to look at the bottom verse. And maybe just so we can make it a little more fun, let's different people read the different verses here. So there's 1, 2, 3. There's 4 translations of this verse 12 up here, and it's all the same Sanskrit. So I think I'll get Doug to read the first one, Dan to read the second one. I'd love to have you read one, Jess, but your mic is having an issue with us. Maybe we'll get Pooja to read the third one and Parul to read the fourth one.
I don't have my book in front of me, Freedom. I can't read it.
All right. So then we'll have Ravi read the fourth one. So go ahead, Doug.
How many lines am I reading there?
Just that first translation.
Okay, that's about...
2 lines.
7 or 8 lines?
No, 2 lines, 2 lines.
Oh, 2 lines, okay.
Yeah, the first 2 lines after the transliteration.
Only education can help us to understand the knowledge of the universe, which is alike an ocean. It enlightens everyone's minds.
All right, Dan.
Saraswati, like a great ocean, appears with her ray. She rules all inspirations.
Now, those are 2 different translations of the same verse. Tell me that they you'd be able to know that. All right. Pooja.
The great river word Saraswati comes forward into perception, illuminating all intelligence like that of a king.
All right. And Ravi.
Saraswati makes manifest by her acts a mighty weapon, and in her own form enlightens all understanding.
That's all the same. That's same verse, 4 different translators. Now tell me which one is right, huh? They're all famous translators too. So the big thing here, when we have some of these verses, they're poetry, and they're very poetic, and they're working with very deep. We saw in that last sukta, the last one. Like, I mean, there's just some deep ideas in there. And so you take those deep ideas, you turn it into poetry. One, if somebody doesn't understand the idea being conveyed, then they're completely lost in their translation. 2, if you do understand what the verse is trying to convey, can you put that same analogy into English? You know, can you talk about the Saraswati, she's a river? But she's also the word, she's language, she's communication. So it's talking about communication being like a river, moving things. You know, a river, I mean, how powerful is a river? And just like a river cleans everything, washes everything, is moving, it's bringing knowledge, it's illuminating, it's bringing understanding. So, you know, this is trying to be communicated here, this analogy between knowledge, learning, language, communication, and the river, and the energy, the power that a river has, and the power that knowledge gives us, that knowledge brings into our life. So I personally think that all these translations butchered it. But this is an example here that's going to happen. And so we just have to be aware of that when we look at Vedic material. All right, this next verse here on the bottom of 20, and the middle one is the same concept. Just looking at those different translations. And so this the bottom one here is my translation, but I give three or four different translations. So depending on what level I want to translate it at. And the first, and this is a very, very, very famous verse, just so you know. Some of these other verses, like those two above here, they're not as famous. They're not that well known. This is one of the core verses of all the Vedas right here. But and it's not the verse, but the concept that this verse is relaying to us. It says, they make offerings to the divine Indra, Mitra, Varuna, Agni, and then the great winged Garuda. The seers speak in many ways of that one being. They make offerings to Agni, Yama, and Martizan. And I tried so hard to put it poetically into English because it's so poetically written. It's such a, in Sanskrit, it's such a beautiful, beautiful verse. It's praying to these different forms of God. And then it's saying, you know, I'm praying to all these different forms of, to you, you know, Indra, to you, Mitra, to you, Varuna. I'm praying to you. And there's all these different names for that one single God. For that one single God, there's all these different names for these different forms and manifestations. And so it's saying, it's praying to all the forms, acknowledging that they're all the aspect of the one. And then after acknowledging that they're all one, it goes back to appreciating them in their various forms. Agni, Yama, Martizan. So it's a really beautiful verse. But now, let's see. And really it's the seers speak in many ways of that one being. So Ekamsat, that one, or the real one, the one existence. So that one divinity, that one existence, the seers have so many names for it. And it's not mentioned here, but the basic Vedic concept is that everything is God. Everything is divinity. Yet, different energies in the universe have different functions. And if we just take that into the Jyotish perspective, we look at the energy of Mars, it's fighting, it's breaking, it's defending. We look at Venus, it's loving, it's healing, it's caring. So one is caring, one is protecting. One is healing, one is you know, has a gun or a stick or whatever it needs to defend. So they're different, and it's all God, right? But then when we get it down, there's different functions of different energies. And so those functions have different names. So the gods are functional realities, functional energies. And anybody here with a Christian background, and all of us as Americans in general, we, even if we never went to church, we're still coming from a Christian concept just because our culture is so Christian. And there's, from the Christian concept, there's a concept of God being this guy up in heaven who's kind of has this concept of right and wrong. And we want to really, when we talk about gods from the Vedic perspective, we really want to get rid of that. That concept of God doesn't exist here. The concept of gods, when we talk about gods and deities, when we talk about Shiva and Ganesh, there's no Ganesh sitting up in heaven saying this is right and this is wrong. But what there is there's a force of love. And this force of love, if we personify it, takes on a certain form. There's a force of defending, of protecting. And if we want to give that force of defending and protecting a form, it's going to take on a very different form than loving and caring. There's a form of, you know, everything is dying. All of us are getting old. There's disease and sickness. If we take that energy, that's a function of the universe. and personify it, it's going to look very different than love and caring. So from the Vedic perspective, the gods are our functional energies, and they're everywhere in everything. And yet it's all from one source, but yet we can name it differently based upon its function. Everybody on page with that one? So there's no Shiva sitting up in heaven saying this is good and that's bad, okay? If we want to get to the deep tantric understanding of Shiva, Shiva is our self-reflective awareness that exists. When Ravi said, is that the Atma? What is Atma? You know, Atma is this self-reflect. It's this thing inside of us that makes us us and not something else. And it's this point of awareness. You, Ravi over there, he's a point of awareness, and I'm a point of awareness over here. And even though there's only one awareness, we're all one, I'm still perceiving, like when I look around my room, it's a different room than he's looking around. But that ability to go inside and tap into that individual essence that is the same essence in me as in him, that's what we call the energy of Shiva. Now, when we want to embody that, we give it a form that's sitting and meditating, because that's representing that energy. So it's all about function. All right. So this, going back to the same verse, let's see. I translate it. I give another translation here just to play with it. And I say, this is pure poetry. It's like, and I give a different analogy here. And I say, it's like saying, honey, sweetheart, beloved, come my one wife, beloved, precious, beautiful. So that's, I just kind of changed what we're referring to here to kind of get the concept. You know, when I say honey, sweetheart, beloved, I'm still talking to my one partner. So my one partner, I'm talking to you and I say, honey, sweetheart, beloved. And so I'm giving her different names, kind of bringing honey, you're my sweetness, you know, my beautiful, my, you know, so I'm bringing out different attributes of her, my one wife. So that's a really material level to look at that verse, analogy. I give an over-anglicized translation. And so I translate, instead of saying Mitra, Varuna, and Agni, another way that it could be translated is oblations or praises to the divine king, to the divine friend, to the great punisher, sacred fire, and the celestial bird. The seers speak of one being in many ways. Sacred fire, lord of death, fanner of the flame, we offer to you. Let's see, so I thought I gave more than... I guess that's it. All right. So that's a, you know, different, so many different ways that we can translate this. So even me translating a verse, I could give three or four translations, depending on how we want to do it. Do I want to keep it Mitra, or do I want to say divine friend? Because Mitra is that energy of friendship. You know, why are some people, we meet them and we know that they're going to be our... You know, some of your closest friends, you knew that they were your friends the first few hours you met them. You met them, you started talking to them, you're like, okay, this is somebody who's my friend here. And then other people you meet and you're like, oh my gosh, this person I can't stand to be around. You know, like, it's a very different energy. So this energy of friend, that's Mitra. And all of us, we want to exude the energy of Mitra. We want to exude the energy of friend. We don't want anybody wanting us to be our enemy or not liking us or anything like that, but it's an energy. So we can translate Mitra, and we can say Mitra, and, you know, just and call him as this in his divine anthropomorphized form, or we can sit there and look at it as that energy of friendship. And I said or. And when we get to the Vedic realm, it's not an or. We're looking at both. And so that brings us down to this second to the bottom paragraph. It talks about the ritualistic, the Adiyagya, It talks about the theological, the adidaivata, and it talks about the internal, the adhyatma. So when we talk about it as the energy of the friend, we're looking at the adhyatma level. When we say Mitra as a god, and we look at him as this solar kind of energy, we're looking at him on a theological level. When we're doing rituals and we're doing mantras, we're looking from a ritualistic perspective. So we're looking, it's not this way or that way, it's all of that. We're in both realms. And this is a hard one for some people to grasp. And even in the Hindu world, some people have a hard time with this. And the reason for that is to really be able to grasp something on three levels at the same time, it takes, I've learned recently, the Western term is called a post-conventional personality development. If you have post-conventional personality development, then it's very easy to do these three levels. And what it basically means is, you know, as a kid, if you look at a two-year-old, what can a two-year-old understand? What can a five-year-old understand? Very different than what a 12-year-old can understand. And that's very different than what a 21-year-old can understand. And what research has shown is around 25... 27 kind of zone, the average person just kind of stops. That's as far as they get. You know, they're maturing, and then they just get to this point where they just don't mature anymore. And even though they're getting older, they're not maturing. Post-conventional personality development is the maturities that's happening after that age. Somebody who's doing deeper work and questioning and inquiring and saying, okay, I was told this, but like, what does that mean to me? What's the deeper level? How can I see this on a grander scale? How can I see the same in him as in me? How can I see our similarity? How can you, and really what we see right now in our politics in the US is we have a bunch of people who haven't got to that higher level. They're still in that 20-something age group where they're rooting for their team. We're all about, yay, our team won, our team's gonna kick your team, and your team, we're gonna throw you out. They haven't got to the point where they're like, oh, we're all on the same team here. You're a human, I'm a human. We're both a pulsing, existing, loving being. You know, they're not looking on this higher maturity level. So these three levels, to be able to understand all of them, it's not just that next level up, but it's really, it takes development to perceive these energies on this higher level. And one of our goals in the realm of astrology is to get to that higher maturity, that higher mental maturity. And as we learn astrology, it matures us. If you take the astrology seriously, if you're paying attention to what these planets are meaning and the implications, you will get matured. It will mature you. It will make you grow and to a much deeper level. When we realize that every single person has Saturn somewhere in their chart and everybody's suffering somewhere, We don't start looking at rich people and saying, oh, that person has they're a billionaire. Their life's good. I wish I was like them. We get to a point where we're like, you know, they're a billionaire. They might have Jupiter in the second house, but their Saturn is smashing something else. I'm quite happy that Saturn is where he is in my chart, and I'd rather have Saturn there than have that suffering that person has and be a billionaire. So we get to this higher level of seeing things. And that's just one little example that helps us mature into that next level. Post-conventional personality development. What a big word, huh? All right. Oh no, I do give another translation. So the above verse could also be loosely translated as... Oh yeah, I like this. So this is an adhyatma translation. So the first translation is general, it's more ritualistic. So, you know, Mitra, Varuna, Agni, you know, the seers call you one, and it's worshiping them as gods. So we're in a theological interpretation. Then we have the translation here, divine king, divine friend, great punisher. So, and I read that one already. Then this last one here, the inner ruler, the supportive and punishing self. That means that angel and the devil sitting on your shoulders, you know? It's directly referring to that. Whenever it says Mitra Varuna, it's talking about the angel and the devil on your shoulders. Whenever we see those verses. So, the inner ruler, the supportive and punishing self, consciousness and perception are all divine. The seers speak in many ways of the one self. They are aware of life and death. So that's a real adhyatma. You know, we're really interpreting it as all internal realities. And as I said, not one of these isn't more right than another. They're all existing at the same time. All right. Let's see. Any questions? I'm talking high philosophy here. I'm gonna skip a few things. So those were just some verses from the Rig Veda. Then there's Yajurveda, some verses, some Samaveda verses. All that's on the online video. Atharva Veda. I'm gonna jump over to Atharva Veda. So Atharva Veda. Let's see. Anybody here familiar with Atharva Veda? As opposed to the other Vedas. So in around 3000 BC time period, or 3000 BCE, politically correct is BCE. We can't say BC anymore. I got yelled at a few times at some conferences. So around 3000 BCE, there was three primary Vedas, and the Atharva Veda, they were those guys over there. The Atharva Veda wasn't part of the main Vedas, and it was actually the school of Parashara that, you know, there was big changes happening. They were suffering climate change. The main river that their life revolved around was drying up. And as it was drying up, people were moving, cities were moving. It was a big deal. And religion was changing and shifting, and the Vedic culture was in a transformation similar to what they are in at the moment. You know, everything was changing, and how does the Vedic culture modernize to fit where everything is going? And at that time, the Atharva Veda became an accepted Veda. And so it became four. So it went from three Vedas to four Vedas. And I say that because the Atharva Veda is very different. The first three Vedas, there's so much similarity. When we get to the fourth Veda, we enter the realm of magic. We enter the realm of spells. We entered the realm of taking different types of herbs and putting a spell on them and putting it on and it protecting you from disease. So for some really purist types, some of the stuff in the Atharva Veda is very low-end magic. For people who like magic, the Atharva Veda is a well of really awesome spells and magic and concepts. One of the things we get from the Atharva Veda is there's a lot of Ayurvedic concepts that are hidden within the Atharva Veda. let's see, do I want to say any more? We go a little bit into the Atharva Veda has a thing called a sukta called the Kala Sukta, the worship of time in it. And we talked last week a little about time being perceived as a divinity. So they have a whole verse in there that's worshiping time as God. Really beautiful verse that I love a lot. I don't know if I'm going to go any more into that. But you can see here I just gave little simple mantra against sorcerers and demons, mantra for obtaining a husband, mantra with licorice to secure the love of a woman. all these kind of mantras. And anybody interested, you know, I recommend you can go online and you can read some of these translations. But always remember, you know, those the four translations I gave you. It's only going to, if you really want to study something, you want to read a few translations. That way you can kind of get to the heart of it a little bit more. All right, four parts of the Vedas. So I think this is the, we're not going to do the Angas. We're going to do the four parts of the Vedas, and maybe we'll get to Angas tonight. But for conceptual reality, this four parts is the important thing I want to be communicated, that we want to live within, that we want to understand, that we want to have frame our perspective, our reality. So the Vedas are divided into the mantras, the four Vedas that are just the mantras, like all the verses we just read, you know, just those verses, and they're just chanted and sung, there's nothing else. Then there's a group of texts called the Brahmanas, and the Brahmanas are rituals. Okay, so we got these verses, how do we do rituals with them? And then there's the Aranyakas. And the Aranyakas, they're, how do we do internal practices? What does this mean? What's the purpose of it? And then we have the Upanishads. And the Upanishads, what's the essential knowledge? So if you looked at how I interpreted some of those verses on different levels, the Brahmanas, we would be interpreting the Vedic texts in a ritual context. In the Upanishads, we would be interpreting it more on the Adi-Daivata level, looking at it as deities and energies and what these energies are doing. When we get to the Upanishads, what is this on the internal level? Who am I? What is this telling me about me? And yes, it talks about the universe, but if the universe is like that, what's that mean about me? Or vice versa. If I'm breathing, and when my breath leaves me, I die. What does that mean about the universe? And you look around and you see the moon is getting bigger and smaller and bigger and smaller. The seasons, the sun's getting brighter and colder and warmer and colder. You know, there's just this pulsation that exists everywhere. So in the Upanishad level, we're really taking it inside to see what this internal level is. So we have all four of these realms. And in general, the first 25 years of life are connected to the Vedic Samhitas. And in traditional Vedic culture, they just memorize the Vedas. They don't even know what they mean sometimes. They're just learning to chant them. The next 25 years, officially, the person is doing rituals. They're using these Vedic verses and all that kind of stuff, doing a ritual to get a better job, doing a ritual to find a house, a place to live, doing a ritual so that we have a fair election and we get a good king to rule us. Somebody failed there recently, huh? But we'll see, Mr. Trump, you know? So that's 25 to 50. Then from 50 to 75, we enter the Aranyaka realm. And so we're looking at the energies. We're looking at them as devas and on the Devic realm, and what are they representing, and how do we work with these energies? And then 75 to 100, we're in the Upanishadic realm. We're in the, what is the essence? Who am I? What's the purpose of existing? What is this pulsation inside of me? Why am I pulsing? Why am I breathing? Where does this breath come from? Let me go inside and find the source of this breath. So, on one level, it's breaking down practice into four levels. It's breaking down our life into four levels. And let's see, how do I want to present this? On one level, you know, and particularly as Westerners, we love this Upanishadic level. A lot of people just like to jump right into, what's the essence? What's this mean about me? But from the Vedic perspective, We got to learn each part. And by learning the rituals, by learning the forces of nature and the deities, all that makes us have a deeper understanding of our own self. There's a progression through this. When we are reading charts for somebody, and somebody says, what should I do at this stage of my life? And we're about to give them advice. We're giving them advice within this paradigm. You meet somebody who's 76, and they're saying, should I go back to college? Should I da 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 da? And they've entered the Upanishadic time period. At this stage, it's our goal as astrologers to guide them to into their spiritual realm, into realizing who they are, into making sure that they're looking at themselves and really taking that deeper level of their being. Somebody who's 25 to 50, they come to us, we're guiding them in how to have a successful life, how to manifest things in the world. Somebody before 25, we're guiding them in what they should be learning and how they're going to be, what school should they be going to? What knowledge should they be picking up? Should they travel here? Should they intern over there? So we're using this. This is a frequency paradigm, a way to look at the world. So it's a body of knowledge that's framed into four parts. It's overlaid in our life. It's also overlaid in charts that different people have a prominence in one of these areas than another. Let's see. Am I getting that across good enough? How the Vedas are divided into four and how we actually use them. And the thing is, I say how we actually use them. Every single thing we can use. Do we as astrologers try and tell a person what religion is right? If you try and tell somebody what religion is right, then you're not doing Vedic astrology. Can we know what religion is right? According to Vedic philosophy. No, we can't know what's right. We only know what we know. We only know what we practice. We're humble. So these little lessons on the Vedas, and as the course goes on, there's Vedic knowledge sprinkled everywhere, but we're using these Vedic paradigms for how do we make choices? How do we guide people? What stage of life are they in? What's the important part right now? Is somebody over-focused in one area and they're missing some other aspects? Somebody gets too into one area and they lose their grounding. And a lot of times, the people, they jump into that Upanishadic consciousness and they can't pay their bills. They say, oh, I don't do rituals. I'm just Om Tat Sat. I'm just going to realize myself. And you say, great, you just want to realize yourself? Go live in a monastery. Have no money. Go realize yourself, have no money. If you want a successful life, then we have to do some pujas. We have to worship God. You're going to need some mantras here. But yet, if somebody comes to you and they're at that stage of life where it is Upanishadic realm, you say, forget about the house. Give it to your kids. It's time to retire. Retire, focus on yourself, do meditation. You don't need to. So this is guiding how we give advice. And it's ensuring that we're giving advice in a holistic way. So we're not making somebody be a materialist. We're not making somebody be a spiritualist. There's a stage of life where we got to make sure that the world is working. There's a stage of life where we got to make sure that our spirit is being fed. And at all times, we want to make sure the spirit's fed, but there's a time where that becomes the prominent work, the prominent goal. All right. Next, the Mahavakyas. I always got to have something to drink or else my throat gets too dry talking too much. So the Mahavakyas are, according to the Vedic sages, meaning the guys who fully understand what this knowledge is in the Vedas. They take this whole, you know, you see all the books behind me. They've taken all the Vedic knowledge and they've said, you know, we're going to condense it. We're going to condense it into little tiny verses. That way you can get the point of what's in the Vedas. And if you get this point, then you've got the most important knowledge that the Vedas are trying to give you. So these Mahavakyas are important, right? On page 27. So, and we'll go with number two, the second one. I'll start with that one for the moment, because the first one is much, much deeper to explain. So it's Aham Brahmasmi. Aham Brahmasmi. Aham means I am. Brahma, or it means I. Brahma means God. Asmi am. I God am. I am God. And let's talk for a minute about what this term Brahma means. So does it, when it says I'm God, does it mean that you're some guy with a beard sitting in heaven deciding what's right and wrong and who's going to live forever and who's going to burn in hell? No, definitely not. Like, put that into a compartment somewhere else. This term, you know, and they translate it as God. And it's so hard because what God means to some people, you know, the Brahman doesn't mean that. What Brahman means, Brahman has this concept of it's growing, it's emerging. And let me real fast pull out the exact. Let's see. I want to give
it. Is it what they say, the unified field of consciousness?
That's a nice way. That's, you know. And how do I say? It's a nice unifying field of consciousness. Was that Ravi? Yeah. And so unifying field, there's no word unifying in it. And there's no word consciousness in it. So when somebody translated it as unifying field of consciousness, that was their interpretation. They're trying to relay a concept. And I'm not saying it's wrong, but that's a view that's put on top of this term Brahman. And I'll just, the root, Brahma, That the actual root, if we look in this in Sanskrit, means growth, expansion, evolution, developing, swelling, outpouring. Let's see. Yeah. So it's this thing that's growing, it's outpouring, it's swelling, it's expanding. And now, how do you put that in English? And I'll tell you, there is no real way to put it in English because English just doesn't have a word that fits. But it's this thing that, you know, from nothingness, everything is coming out of it. Everything, this whole universe. And we're breathing, we're pulsing. There's trees growing. There's animals. There was dinosaurs. There's buildings being grown. There's oceans moving. There's solar systems, and the solar systems are being born. Universes are being born. So from nothing, there's this growth, there's this expansion, there's this development, there's this outpouring. And if we look, that's on the material level. On the level of soul, there's this consciousness that's coming forth. There's awareness that's coming forth. You're perceiving, you're looking, you're knowing, you're feeling. You can be happy and you can feel happy. You can be tired and feel tired. You're experiencing. So and you can go somewhere and have an ecstatic state. So the consciousness is expanding, it's blooming, it's swelling out, it's developing. You're growing. Everything is growing. You look around, is anything going to be static? Look at your house where you live. In 100 years, what's that house going to look like? In 1,000 years, what's your town going to look like? In 10,000 years, will that town even exist anymore? So, you know, like everything is just going and it's expanding and moving and consciousness, you know, it just, new souls keep getting born. New thoughts keep arising. New ideas come up. New music is created. New, you know, from nothing, all this is coming and then going back. So this Brahman is this which is effusing, it's outpouring. Everything is coming forth from it. Now, we can call it the unifying field of consciousness, but does that fully, you know what I mean? To me, it's that's part of it. And yeah, all consciousness is in it, all consciousness is coming from it, you know, but it's bigger. And it's real important. Brahman is a neuter word. Meaning it's not male, it's not female. So it's not some god, it's not some goddess. It's the outpouring. Or that which is outpouring from. Or however you want, you know, I point it to what it's meaning. I'm not going to give it I'm going to leave it as Brahman. Because we're going to understand what Brahman means, right? Instead of trying to put it in the English. Because the English isn't good enough. In my opinion, there's no word in English that catches what Brahman means. Everybody, does anybody choose to disagree with that? I'm happy if you want to debate. I'd love if there was a word for a divinity that represented that. all right, so aham brahmasmi. So when it says, I am God, when we just translate it as God, I mean, we've lost something already, because you're definitely not some a God, you know, in some manifest form. I am this which is, and for those who are on the phone, I'm moving my hands here. Let's see, I'll describe. My hands are from my heart, and they're going up and spreading out and pouring all over. You know, it's this outpouring. It's this development, the evolution, the expansion, that which is expanding from. I am that. That which is expanding and making everything, I am that. So we have this one. That's one of the Mahavakyas. Then we have, look at the last one, because that one resonates similar with the one we just went over. It's Ayam Atma Brahma. And that one we can translate as the indwelling self. That inner being is Brahman. So instead of just saying I am Brahman, it's saying that, you know, within me, my core essence is Brahman. That the essential nature of what I am is Brahman. And I'm going to leave it as Brahman. all right. So the whole Vedas, this is the summary. If we had to sum up all the Vedas into one thing, this is what we're summing it up into. That I am this. And so that's the second one up from the bottom. Tat Tvam Asi. Tat is very similar to the English word. We lost Doug. His internet probably kicked. Tat is similar to the English word that. THAT. There's just no H in here. So tat, tvam, you, asi, are. You are that. But what they mean by that here is they didn't even use the word Brahman. Because if they use the word Brahman, then they're basically like, even that might, the person might not understand what we mean by Brahman. They might even be limited. You know, what is beyond Brahman? What is, if you know, what is the essential nature of everything? What is at the core of the universe, at the core of every human being? That. You are that. I am that. So it's just saying that. It's pointing. It's not even giving it a word. All right. So, turn it back into Jyotish here. So our root, our core essence in Vedic astrology, our core goal is to really help somebody return back to their true nature, to return back to that true essence that they are. And at what stage they are in their life, where they are, when, you know, we got to work with them where they are. We can't take somebody who is you know, their husband just left them and they're crying their eyes out in your office and they want any type of ritual to bring them back, which I'm just using that analogy because it happened recently. But that person, I'm not going to sit there and tell them, oh, your true nature is this divine existence, that which is beyond. Don't cry about your husband. You know, at that point, I got to meet that person where they are. But I got to remember that is my essential nature. And it's my goal to eventually make sure that if this person comes to me, you know, I get people that come to me every year. Sometimes I got people that come to me 2-3 times a year. My eventual goal is to be able to make sure that how they are working with their life, that I'm guiding them into a place and making sure that the blocks that are blocking their spiritual life, the blocks that are blocking their understanding are getting worked through so that they can eventually get to that space of tat tvam asi, I am that. And it's for us, we want to use, we're utilizing this Jyotish to help us also ourselves get to that state where we realize that we are that we are Brahman. So what's the core final goal if we extracted everything down? This the same, because Jyotish is Vedic astrology. We're in the Vedic realm. We put it down into its most core essence. This is its most core essence, right here in these Mahavakyas. And then from those Mahavakyas, we step into the four parts of the Vedas, these four approaches to life. These, you know, we're manifesting the material realm. We're working, you know, we're so we have that division. Yeah. And then we have the perception that we talked about. So that's what I wanted to cover today. Yay. All right. So any particular questions right now relative to how this relates to Jyotish, how to apply to Jyotish, if somebody wants to study more of this, how much you need to study of it, something along that line. Anybody have any questions in that realm? Okay. So I'm not expecting everybody to go and study Vedas and be a Vedic scholar like me. but what I am expecting is that you have familiarity with some of these concepts. And that when there's questions, like, why am I doing this? What's the purpose of this? We have a realm to dig into. We have a realm where there's these answers are, where we can seek answers. And sometimes the answers, particularly in the Vedic realm, are answers. Like if you asked me, so what's the Vedic concept of creation? And I gave you those verses, the verses are more questions than they are answers. But on that certain level, the question is the answer. It's like, you know, who can know? If even God doesn't know, you think you're going to know. So this is the answer. So at that point, you're like, well, maybe God doesn't even know. So maybe I should focus on something else. And that's just a small little example there, but this is our source. This is where we go to answer our questions in this Vedic realm. And why is that important? It's important because Vedic astrology, it's not just this little thing that we do for fun. And you might enjoy it. It might be fun to do. But it's a powerful, powerful reality. And it's a reality. We're entering a conceptual sphere of these concepts and archetypes and deities and energies of the universe. And we're interacting with them. And we're interacting with people. And we're interacting with people in how their life is manifesting. Now, if we go to the Western astrology realm, you know, the depth that they go to, they say, hey, you guys can hear me, yes? Just not see me? I don't know why there I am. All right. In some of the more Western or other systems, you know, they say, hey, you're organized, you're clean, you're like this, or you're secretive, or you like to have fun. You know, there's a very surface level. But when we, in the Vedic realm, we're looking at the depths of someone's soul. We're looking at people, should they get married and have children? Or should they not get married and have children? Somebody will put a chart in front of you and say, should I get married? Or should I go forget about marriage? Should I just get a job and you're going to give them an answer and they're going to put their whole life around that. Vedic astrology, the level that people come to us for and the level that we have the influence on them changes their lives forever. It's so we can have fun learning it, but it's an incredibly powerful knowledge, and its impact on people is deep and carries through sometimes lifetimes. We're guiding people in how they're going to interact with their life, in how they're going to manifest their life, in who they're going to become, in what they're going to put their energy into. So we can enjoy learning, but as soon as we start giving advice, there's Vak Shakti, the power in our speech to influence someone's life becomes really heavy. And I have people at the very end of this, particularly the level one course, drop out. They're like, oh my gosh, I didn't know I could see that much. I don't want to know that much. I don't want anybody to know that much about me. Like, they're like, I'm done. I'm not going here. And in the class, we keep it pretty fun. But we have to realize this is not just a game that we're going into. We're going into how reality is manifesting. And how do we work with that reality that's manifesting? And sometimes how do we alter the reality that's manifesting? How do we change destiny? So when we're looking at that, we want to have questions come up. Should I do this? Is it okay to be doing this? What's the purpose? Like, what? Why? How? Where am I going? We need something that has a firm foundation that can give us clarity in moments of doubt. And so we go back to the Vedic philosophy. Let's see. Any meeting levels? Oh, okay. Pooja and Ravi, if you look at the chat real fast, Parul on here is Parvati is she's trying to get on, and she says that it's only giving us 6 windows for some reason, which I should check in with that, because I'm pretty sure we should be able to get more windows than 6 there. All right, let's see if that works. All right, so let's see. So we had fun. We're looking at depths. We're bringing this into reality. The manifestation of people's lives. So we want to have some firm foundation of how do we live our life. Yeah, I'll work on changing the settings. I'm not sure why it's only letting 6, because it should allow 24, from my understanding. So I'll look into that. All right. All right. So the Vedic philosophy, it serves to give us the goggles to look at things, keeps us humble, keeps us open-minded, grounds us in the proper inquiry. You know, and when I say proper inquiry, it's not giving us what's right and wrong, but what are the questions that we should ask to know about right or wrong? You know, how do we know what's right or wrong? So it's giving us the right questions to look at. And it guides us. And these little seeds of knowledge, they open up deep realms and they mature us. As I said, they mature us so that we have that higher vision to make bigger, grander decisions, and to help those who are in the space of confusion not be stuck in the realm of confusion. All right. Yeah. So we covered the first half of this chapter, which is on some level the most important, because this is our philosophical foundation. And before we go in to start dissecting people's lives, we want to know, who are we to be dissecting somebody's life? Why are we here? What is this universe that we're in dissecting someone's life within? And that's what we got from this first chapter here. And I mentioned it in the beginning of class, but I know a few people came late. So Ian is going to work on the first few pages of chapter 3 next week, and the last few. And where it goes into each planet individually, you guys will do that with me, because that's the archetypal dance. Archetypal dance. Dancing with the archetypes, you know? Dancing with the archetypes. And then when I come back, we'll do this second half, and we'll look at more of these branches of the Vedas, and I'll talk about why and all that kind of stuff, and we'll talk about the different levels of karma. And I recently, for the next version of the book, I added a little section in there on the karma stuff. So we'll talk about that. So for the next class, begin digging in the chapter 3. Whatever you've done in chapter 2, be okay with that. Dig in the chapter 3 so that you're on page with Ian next week. And then we'll come back, and Ian will leave you with going back to the second half of chapter 2. That way we have strong Vedic foundations. And even if we don't know the answer, we have a concept of where to look. Yeah. All right. Yay. Let's see. We have a few minutes left. So Ian and I, we talked how Ian's gonna work with me, And just so you guys know, if Ian wasn't working with me, I probably wouldn't teach another level one for maybe 2 years. he's making it so that I, you know, can be putting more of my energy into research right now than teaching exaltations and debilitations, which I've taught for the last 15 years. So, Ian is great. As far as the chapter breakdown, I'm going to mostly cover chapter 2 with you, just because of its Vedic nature. And Ian is, he's not initiated into the Vedas. And without that initiation, he doesn't have Adhikara to teach Vedas. And what does that mean? Let's see. You can see this little string right here. See that little, those who can see the picture. So there's a string that goes from this shoulder across my body like this. And that string comes from a particular initiation that's based upon the Gayatri Mantra. And there's a sadhana that goes with it, and you have to learn so much. And there's certain rituals that need to be done daily. And then an initiation happens into the Gayatri, and that Gayatri is the initiation into the Vedas. And then there's additional initiations that go with that. But as a Vedika, as somebody who is initiated into the Vedic knowledge, this string is worn across. And it's the only thing that a Vedika wears. And when I say it's the only thing that a Vedika wears, I'm going to put that into a different perspective. So, Guru, I think it's Gobind Singh, the founder of Sikhism. Is that what it? The founding guru of Sikhism. He was born into a Brahmana family. And when it came time to get his initiation of the sacred thread, he said, "I don't want to wear that thread." He said, "If I put that thread on, that makes me different than everybody else. I don't want to be acting like I'm better than other people and wearing the string and separating me. I'm one with everybody." And so he went around doing his best to unite people and unite Hindus and Vedicas and Muslims. And, you know, he tried to bring everybody together. A few hundred years later, the Sikhs, they have to carry a knife. They wear the turban, they have their beards a certain, so they're very separated. For, you know, you can recognize one anywhere you go. You can recognize a Sikh who's wearing their standard religious regalia. And so just to, you know, every religion has like what they wear, what makes them them. And so the sacred thread is what a Vedika wears. And it signifies somebody who's living in the realm and working with this Vedic knowledge, who's practicing, who's chanting, who's doing the Vedic rituals, who's memorizing the mantras and, you know, all four branches that we talked about, realizing their internal meaning and taking them into to the deeper levels. But any which way, that's why I'm teaching the Vedic chapter, because really, to teach Vedas, you're supposed to have that initiation. In the Graha chapter, the beginning and the end of it is all things that need to be memorized. You know, what are the elements of the planets? What are the gunas of the planets? These kind of things. And so Ian is going to explain what they are, why they are, maybe give a little example of how they're used, and then you're going to study them with him. And he's going to make sure that you're studying and memorizing everything that needs to be memorized. In the middle section there, I go in and I give a little insight into each of the planets, and I open up their archetypal frequencies. And that's really, my goal is to open it up. So it's, on a certain level, it's like an initiation. It's like introduction to the archetype. And so we'll go through that together. I don't know what'll come out. It's, you know, you guys draw out what comes out of me, what I end up talking about. But our goal is to get to know the planets on a level where you're not memorizing a list, but you understand who they are, as if they were a person. You know, as if I, you know, how do I could say Doug is a, and it was chiropractic, right? You were a chiropractor. I can say Doug was a, is a chiropractor. But does that mean you know Doug? So what can I say about Doug so that you know who he is? So that you can understand his nature. So that's our goal, to know the planets so that we understand their nature, not just a list of things. Chapter 4, I always cover that slightly differently. So we'll see by that time how Chapter 4 gets covered. And that's where we talk about the devatas connected to the planets. Chapter 5 and Chapter 6, Ian is going to be primarily working with you guys on those chapters. I will probably introduce both of those chapters, and he will work with the rules and making, because it's a lot of memorization in those chapters. And so after 5, 6, and 7, there's a little review time. And it's at that point that you guys got to like really, we'll, you know, if we got to take off a month or just have study sessions for a month, at that point we got to make sure that everything before chapter 7 is memorized and we're all on the same page. And if you don't memorize everything at that point, everything that we go forward gets to be difficult. If everything is memorized at that point, then as we go forward, it all gets to be fun because we're using everything that we memorized. And so after that, I'll be doing primarily the philosophy. If there's stuff that need to be memorized or calculated, Ian is going to be helping with that. And that's looking ahead. That's our next few months, really, right here. Real fast, Perul and Amritavidya is not here today. Let's see, is she on the phone there? No.
I'm here.
Yeah, you're there. Amritavidya, I was saying. You and Amritavidya, you know, did a little bit in the last class, and so you're coming at this with a slightly different level, and so for you and Amritavidya, really what I recommend, being that it's, you know, you guys are coming at this from a much more just a different level, while Ian is going over the basics of these techniques, really what I want you two to be doing is looking in Parashara, look in Varahamihira and some of the other classics. So when a particular technique is being taught, like let's say it's time to talk about the signs and the elements, look in those texts. See, what does Parashara say versus Varahamihira, versus Kalyanavarma? You know, so really use this, use this not just to review the same level, but really take it to the next level where you can really get classical. Get really know what do the classics say. And that way, you know, when it comes time to discuss these things, it's not that, well, somebody says da 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 da. It's according to Parashara, Gemini is like this. According to, you know, and we get to something and you disagree and you can say, oh yeah, but Varahamihira says da 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 da. Okay, so take that time because, you know, everybody else is going to be spending more time memorizing. Use that same amount of time to go and dig a little deeper into the classics. Okay? All right. That way it's rooted. You're in the roots. And when you're in the roots, and you know, this is a fun little class, but you know, when we get into these online forums and other places, people argue about different techniques and how to interpret things. And when you get into those realms where it's this bigger discussion, you can give your opinion, and opinion means only so much. If we know what Parashara says, if we know what these different rishis say, we have clarity. And we have that which is cannot be disagreed with. It's that which we come from, we start from. We expand from that instead of making something up and seeing how it relates. And yeah, we'll just leave it at that. As we go into that section, I'll work with you two a little bit. I'll make sure that you two are being aware of that zone and actually digging deeper into that side of things. All right. And for those who it's your first time in class with me, which we have Pooja and Ravi, Doug, Jess, Dan, and Kalina didn't come this time. I don't know. She didn't come last time either. We'll see. Hopefully she's with us. Hopefully she makes it. So these... And I mentioned this slightly in the last class. Right now, we're learning concepts. And there's these concepts that we're memorizing, we're putting in our head. On a certain level, you want to jump and just do some Jyotish. Relax. Right now, just take the next week to dig into the Vedas a little bit. Dig into these memorizing the nature of the planets. Don't need to jump too fast. Take your time to really digest the planets. And you know, you're going to be getting ready for Ian's class next week. And then after that, digging back into the Vedas for the class to come after that. Take your time. Really digest this information. Because when we do get into actually doing the charts, this the deeper you have this, the deeper you're going to be able to dig into the charts. So no need to rush. Once we get to the second half, once we get past chapter 7, we're going to be using all of our charts. We're going to be reading the charts. We're going to be working with each other's charts. I'm going to sit there and say, yes. I'm going to sit there and say, okay, Doug, tell me how that works in Ravi's chart. And then I'm going to say, okay, Dan, tell me how that's working in Jess's chart. And so we'll be using everybody's charts, and we're going to have plenty of time working with all that. So no rush. Let's dig really deep into each chapter as we go through it. All right. Ah. Good to have you all here. And enjoy class with Ian next week, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thank you, Frida.